We're in James 3, 13 through 18. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you, Ashley, and thank you guys for inviting me back. It's always a treat to be here. I couldn't even count the number of times I've been here by now, and it's always a delight. I think Moffitt and I share something in common in terms of the warmth of the welcome we've both received from you guys. So we're profoundly grateful for that. What I'd like to talk about today comes obviously from this passage of James. If you just noted the last phrases that were read there, describing this vision of sowing in peace that you might reap a harvest of righteousness. And I think about that phrase and I'm just like, yeah, what are we sowing with our words? James is somewhat preoccupied in this book, throughout the book, with the tongue and our speech and the way we carry on verbally. And he's giving us a bit of a vision here for, wouldn't it be great to live in a place of righteousness? If that's what you would like, try sowing peace. Clearly, he didn't live in 2024, or at least wise he didn't get news feeds from 2024. And we have become acclimated to acrimony. We have become people who are accustomed to biting vitriol directed at the, quote, other side. But the funny thing is, once you start having wars, the number of friendly casualties that you have and the frequency with which damage is done within your own community and on your own side. I was reading a blog post article kind of a thing from someone, and they were describing, as she put it, a family Thanksgiving dinner gone bad. And all the kids and grandkids from their family had come to their house, and she noted, "We homeschooled our sons, cultivating strong critical thinking, literacy, adherence to biblical truth, and a commitment to founding doctrines of liberty and freedom. However, two sons' political leanings veered left. Two remain conservative or even libertarian, and then one was somewhere in the middle." So I want you to picture this. They got five sons, all of them married, all with kids, and this is a happy Thanksgiving dinner. They're having a delightful time, she said, and it was a delightful Thanksgiving until it wasn't. One loose comment, a snarky comeback, and suddenly a torrent of animosity erupted. One son stormed out of the dining room, another took the kids out to play. A pregnant wife ran outside sobbing and collapsing into a patio chair in the front yard. Their two-year-old daughter stood protectively beside her, patting her hand, repeating, "It's going to be okay, Mommy. It's going to be okay." Eventually, my sons returned, avoiding eye contact with everyone else. Soberly, each hugged his wife and said sadly, "Let's go home." And suddenly, our house was eerily quiet. I straightened up, discovering forgotten stuffed animals, teeny little socks, and a frayed blanket, sure to be missed by bedtime. Was my close-knit family beginning to fray as well? Our desire to speak the last word led us to speak angry words, and then finally, not to speak any words at all. It's quite a description. I think the worst part is most of us can relate. I don't know if I would have been confident saying that about 10 years ago. But somewhere in the last season, the divisions that used to go between groups have now descended and go within groups, or sometimes within individual human hearts. And divisiveness, division, and the destruction that it brings has become sort of endemic to modern life in America. And James is worried about how we speak, how we talk to each other. He's worried about conversations like this, and he's very aware of the fact that these conversations don't just happen between Christians and non-Christians, but particularly in this book, he's worried about the conversations going on within the church in his time and his place. And as you read James and you read about the tongue in James' mind, you might ask yourself the question, does James think that the tongue is good or evil? The answer is yes. In fact, he almost always assumes the tongue will be good or evil and almost never neutral. You need to be really careful to think about what you speak because it's almost always being spoken in one cause or another. And the way he describes it in this passage, there's kind of two different groups you can line up with. You can line up with God and the wisdom that comes from above, and when you speak the words that you speak, you'll be speaking, well, you'll be sowing seeds of peace that will yield a harvest of righteousness. The other side, he literally calls demonic wisdom that's born of strife and selfish ambition. And the result of this is every chaotic form of disorder you can imagine. And so the bottom line is the tongue good or evil? The answer is yes. Therefore, choose wisely. So let me take a few minutes and unpack the kind of wisdom that James is recommending that we practice, because I think the words that he spoke so many thousand years ago now are words that need to be spoken to us again today. So James chapter 3, verse 13 through 18, he has this discussion about wisdom. I'd like to begin by making kind of a general distinction between wisdom and knowledge, and then look at the things he says about wisdom after that. James seems to feel like wisdom is proven by its results. The kind of wisdom you're practicing cascades into one or the other set of results. And in that sense, wisdom is somewhat different than knowledge. Here's an interesting way to put it. Knowledge enables you to get things done. Wisdom enables you to do the right things. And wisdom, in that sense, always has what you might call a moral valence. It points to good things. And James's only anxiety is, whose wisdom are you using? Because wisdom is always going to be pointed at accomplishing your vision of the good, but he just says there's a real difference between the heavenly vision of the good and the earthly demonic vision of the good. Divine wisdom gets things done that God thinks are good. Demonic wisdom gets things done that demons think are good. This is not that wisdom that comes down from above, the demonic wisdom, but it's described as earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there will be disorder in every vile practice. This is actually nicely described in a note from a commentary that I was looking at. The final result, it says, of such Satan-driven worship, that's probably a good phrase for capturing the idea there, can only be disorder in every vile practice. The term disorder connotes a chaotic frenzy of fighting in the church, or perhaps in the family. The description the woman gave of what happened to her idyllic Thanksgiving dinner is the perfect image of the chaotic frenzy that results when we follow the practices of demonic wisdom. I'll tell you right now, I would not be using that word demonic to describe the wisdom if James didn't use that word. But it underscores how profoundly significant he thinks that kind of division is, and the kind of work you're doing when you sow the seeds of division rather than sowing the seeds of peace. Much of James, particularly the heart of the book, chapters 3 and 4, is concerned with the power of the tongue to create either good or evil, to accomplish what God thinks is good or what Satan thinks is good. And let me just give a quick observation about this. We as evangelicals want to stand on God's word. We want to be on God's side for sure. But we have a tendency to think of being on the right side of an issue means, well, basically a matter of the head, believing the right things, getting truth and getting it right, accurately handling the word of truth, to borrow the language that Paul uses to describe this in 2 Timothy chapter 2. But the interesting thing here is in this context, James is actually, he's not unconcerned with truth, but he's most concerned with the heart of being good, of the fruit of righteousness, of the fruit of the Spirit, which is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Doesn't that sound like a night spent on social media? You think of how foreign those terms are for describing conversations we have today, and I don't care who you're talking to, Christian, non-Christian, conservative, progressive, whatever your tribal affinity is, everyone seems to perceive the animosity and polarization that we do. The thing that I worry about is we don't worry about it enough. We don't bother even thinking about, could this possibly be demonic wisdom, that we're lining up on the wrong side with the way we're engaging these conversations. So James is very worried about the heart and not just the head. We have a knack for saying things like, well, I just spoke my mind. Indeed. But you spoke your heart too. And I'm just wondering if the two sounded the same. Because I'm struck sometimes by hearing people just speak their mind and declare the truth. But I have to admit, it sounded for all the world like anything other than love. And James is very worried about that kind of speaking the truth. And I should point out, James is far from alone in terms of that anxiety in the New Testament. Lots of New Testament writers are worried not just about what we say, but how it is said, not just about our heads, but our hearts. So Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13, if I understand all the mysteries and have all knowledge, but have not love, I'm nothing. He goes on to compare this to the clanging cymbal, chaotic noise. That's what I am in the absence of love. Ephesians 4 tells us to speak the truth in love. Relative to non-believers, 1 Peter 3, verse 15 says, always be ready to have an answer, but to deliver it with gentleness and respect. Notice this unrelenting concern for matching up the message of the head with the message of the heart, that the truth be spoken with love, and the concern for thinking that those two things can be neatly parsed, because the bottom of the line is out of the fullness of the heart, the mouth speaks. Wow. And let me just make the observation that there's sort of two ways you can be a heretic. I'm not sure that's the word I want to use, but I'm not going to quibble about the details. You can be a heretic, you can be apostate, you can be unfaithful and stop following Jesus. Whatever term you want to use, you can either deny the truth or you can refuse love. Right? Either one is departing from the way of Jesus. And either one should be of grave concern to the wellness of our soul and the health of our communities. So let's take a little bit closer look at the kind of wisdom that James presents for us. We've kind of taken a glimpse at the downside, which is important to figure out, okay, this is what we're facing here. But let's turn our attention now and say, okay, so what would it look like to do differently? So James gives this whole cascade of phrases. First pure, then peaceable, open to reason, full of goodness and mercy, sincere, all of this sort of language he describes. I'd just like to take a few minutes to unpack and think a little bit more deeply about those terms to try and kind of knead those into the dough of our souls, so to speak, so that we begin to think James-like about what divine wisdom really looks like. So first, regarding purity, the term in the original language is one that is used of holiness, often translated holiness. Set apartness. In other words, it's separated from the things that are corrupting. There's a pureness of motive represented in this. That you appear to be talking to the person because you really are talking to the person. You appear to be showing them care because you really care. There's this authenticity, this correlation between the words you speak and the heart you bring to the message that you share. There's a purity there, not corruption. I'm slow to speak because I genuinely want to hear. Kind of a dying breed, it seems like, in contemporary conversation. Then peaceable, James describes it. And the term peace, shalom, is a term that kind of describes wholeness. This sounds clumsy, but it's a great concept. Shalom is the way it's supposed to be-ness. It's doing things, setting things right, making things whole, healing what's broken. Sometimes they'll use it like if I owed you 20 bucks and I handed you a 20, that means we're now even. They would say you're now shalom. Things are back to the way they're supposed to be. It's a right orderedness of things. And that's an interesting thing to think about. After I had this conversation with a person, when we were done talking, were things more whole than when you started the conversation? Are they less divided or more divided? Do people feel more broken or less broken after the conversation? Is it a conversation that makes peace? A conversation that extends shalom? Gentle and open to reason. Willingness to hear the other side and to enter into the hearts and minds of those who you're talking to. It's interesting when people share something that you like profoundly disagree with. You can almost see two immediate impulses. And let me just kind of, this is a bit of an artificial distinction, but it's helpful to think about this way. One of them arcs up to the head, the other one arcs down into the heart. Somebody says something's wrong, your first thought is, let me correct it. Let me speak the truth back. Let me speak a prophetic word. The other thing that might happen when someone says something that's wrong is you would suddenly say, oh, that's wrong. They're perhaps not following the way of Jesus, or they've departed from the way of peace. And you might think, I wonder what led them to think that. Now, hot tip. Sometimes there's almost always a wrong in the situation I've described. I hate to be like the bad news dude, but it is possible that the wrong actually lies with you and not the other person. So let me just, I've said that. I'll get that off. I just wanted to point that out. But let's assume, happily, that it's the other person who's wrong. What do you want to say to them? And here's a good thing to stop and ask yourself the question. If they're wrong, the thing that I hope you're concerned about is not you winning an argument, but rather them becoming made whole. And at that moment, you might ask yourself, what would serve that person best? A prophetic word or a pastoral word? A proclamation of truth or the extension of grace and love? And let me just point out, you don't always know ahead of time. Either one's possible. I'm good with being a prophet. I'm good with being a pastor. I'd just like us to have both arrows in our quiver. And I'd hate for one to get old and moldy because we never use it. And so to ask a person to see things differently, say, wow, that's interesting. I've never heard of that before. Tell me the story. Tell me more. Why do you think that way? When did you first start thinking about it? Were there any experiences you had that made that really important? Because I can tell you're kind of supercharged about this. And suddenly, you're leaning into the person. And that person is invited to open up to you. You open the doors of conversation. Had an interesting moment of this was a couple of years ago. Actually, I was down here at Grace. I remember this, and it was a week before I was doing this workshop with a group called Better Braver Angels. So I moderated these workshops where you bring together like seven or eight progressives, seven or eight conservatives, and you put them in a room together for an entire day, and you talk about those differences and help people hear one another. And I was the guy who was moderating this adventure. We were looking for a few more folks to join that, and so I invited you guys, because I was here, like I said, the week ahead of time. We got a few of you who joined us, so you may have been here when we had that conversation. It was a great time. Well, after we did that, I came up, had another meeting, some kind of a thing at Biola or Talbot, but I was talking to a graduate student that I'd worked with some, and he just asked me, so what's going on these days, or what were you doing, or something like that, and I said, oh, I just was doing one of these workshops, so I described him the workshop. And after I described it to him, he says, well, what's the point of doing that if no one changes their opinion afterwards? And I thought, now that is an interesting question. If a person's mistaken and they don't change their opinion, what good is it to talk to them? What's the point? And notice what's happening here is that we have sacrificed an effect, not love per se, but even a vision or awareness of the need and importance of love on the altar of truth. Because that the person does look at that conversation and says, we didn't get progress on truth, so there was no progress that was made. And it would be really interesting if he'd flip that whole thing around and said, well, why do you care about truth when you could have done love? And I would like to suggest that either one of those is not a great plan, but the point is that I would think either would be of value. But it seems like when we're in a situation of conflict, suddenly the only thing we value is truth and getting it right. And we lose sight of love and the other person. You win the debate and you lose the person. And that's not the divine wisdom that comes down from above, that is first pure and then peaceable, and then gentle and open to reason. It's not the kind of love that is full of mercy and good fruits. It'd be interesting if you could imagine having a conversation with someone in a coffee shop or some other place like that, and you talk for a couple hours about whatever stuff you're talking about. You leave, the other person's sitting there, and somebody comes up and says, so what was that guy selling? Because you can see the intensity of the conversation. And you might ask, Would it seem likely to say they were selling good fruit and mercy? Is that what you were marketing? Were those the wares that you brought to the market that day? Or were you offering something else? James is giving us some pretty provocative words about the things we say in the context of our disagreements. Finally, he talks about being impartial and sincere. The idea of saying, let me treat the other viewpoint fairly. Let me be impartial. And let me genuinely care about what that person cares about. I've been on a little low-grade campaign, partly because of seeing this problem in my own life. Because, my PhD's in philosophy. I'm paid to argue and have different opinions. One of the great things about being a philosophy professor, which I'm not usually what I'm actually teaching, but teaching philosophy is great because you can keep the same final exam every semester, you just change the right answers, right? I mean, it's a great job, I'm telling you. It doesn't pay worth much, but man, the finals are wonderful. So there's a sense in which I am always drawn into these kinds of things. This is in my bones. But one of the things that's really interesting is to stop and say when you are, well, let me put it this way, to aspire to achieving disagreement. Now, you might think, Rick, get the memo from 2024. Everyone has achieved disagreement. That's what I disagree with. I think that's the thing we almost universally fail to do. Here's what it means to achieve disagreement. It means that you and I have talked, and I understand your viewpoint well enough that I can state it in a way that you would say, yes, that's it. And not only do I agree with what you just said about my opinion, you got the feeling of it right. This is why you care so much about that issue. This is why it's so important to you. And until I do that, the other person, if they were in the room and I was saying, this is what John thinks, John would be sitting there listening to me, that's not what I think. And they would have to unpack it two or three times till you finally got it right. And here's my thought. If I can't get right what John's thinking, how can I possibly know that I disagree with him? Achieving disagreement is a noble feat because it's required you to be impartial and sincere, to really understand them and really care about what they say and feel about the thing that they've claimed. Totally different than saying you agree with them. That's why I call it achieving disagreement. But it's vital to healthy communities, be they in the church or be it in the public square. Okay, so those are some of the things that James kind of casts a vision for. Just one little side turn I want to take here before I finish, and that is to talk about my lawn. You were probably hoping I'd get to that part, right? No, here's the deal. I bought a house back in 1986, and I inherited. The house wasn't in bad shape, but somehow the lawn had experienced botanical acts of violence. I have no idea who had done what to it and how they possibly could have that much damage done to dirt, but they had somehow managed to do this. And so I'm trying to figure out, okay, that lawn is now my lawn. What am I going to do with this thing? So I talked to one of the guys in my church, was at the time an older guy, and he was one of the pioneers of sod. So he was a farmer in Indiana, and they were, you know, the big boom in the suburbs, everyone's, you know, putting up these houses and planting fresh lawns when they wanted to sell it. And so he figured out they made a machine to cut the sod like that little 2-inch strip of sod that has the dirt in it that you can just plop in and the sod grows. Well, he was one of the guys who pioneered that. So I figured the perfect guy to talk to is Don, because he is like the grass guru, you know, of planet Earth. So I go find Don and I tell him, you know, describe the devastation that is my yard. And I start telling him about all the weeds and all the problems and all this stuff. And he kind of just puts up his hand partway through. It was a pretty eloquent discourse he interrupted. But nonetheless, he thought it was time to speak up and said, Rick, don't worry about killing the weeds. Grow the grass. Here's what you need to do. Fertilize it every holiday. Fertilize it on Easter. Fertilize on Memorial Day. Fertilize it on the 4th of July. Fertilize it on Labor Day. And I'm like, should I use weed and feed? He says, if you have to, but just fertilize the grass, because if the grass is healthy, it will take care of the weeds. Now, I got that advice the better part of 40 years ago. Not been perfect advice, but it's been pretty good. It's been pretty good. And it's amazing how often creating healthy, fill in the blank, grass in this case, keeps you from having to spend all your time worrying about the weeds and the other evils of your lawn. It's really similar with conversations. You want to worry about all the polarization and all the animosity and all the things that are going on. You can worry about those things, and it's good to be aware of them, but you know the best thing you can do is just have different kinds of conversations. Let me have healthy conversations. Let me extend to people what I'm going to call conversational hospitality. Let me welcome other people into my conversational space. My guide for thinking about this is a man named Aelred, who was a monk. And the book that he wrote is called Spiritual Friendships, published, I think, in 1098 AD. So it's been around for a while. Fair bit of wisdom packed into this book. And it's written as kind of a dialogue. So Aelred was an abbot, so the head of a monastery, a monastic community, and he records the book in this, you know, dialogical form. So let me just pick up his comment here. He said, not long ago, he's talking to this brother who came with him a question about forming friendships and the importance of conversation. He said, not long ago, while I was relaxing among a crowd of brothers, on every side, everyone was adding to the din. One was questioning and another debating. One was raising questions about scripture, another about ethics, one about virtue, another about vice. You alone were silent, this brother he was talking to. Suddenly, raising your head in the group, as if you were about to add a remark, your voice seemed to stick in your throat, and then you lowered your head and you fell silent, withdrawing a short distance from us, and again returning, but you looked crestfallen. From all of this, I was led to conclude that hating crowds and preferring privacy, you hesitated to express what was on your mind. And let me just pause in this little thing here to notice the first thing that Aelred did was, even in the midst of the conversation, he was so aware of the people in the room. And for some of us, it's like once we get the debate going, the only thing in the room are disembodied ideas. For Aelred, there's no such thing as a disembodied idea, only people. Only people. And he had an eye for people. And so he goes on with this monk and he says, "Now, no one else is present to disturb our peace or to interrupt our friendly conversation. No voice, no noise invades our pleasant retreat. You and I are here, and I believe Christ is here with us. So, most beloved brother, open your heart now and pour whatever you please into the ears of a friend. Gratefully, let us welcome the place, the time, and the leisure to talk." What a wonderful image of what I've called conversational hospitality. You just see him opening the doors of his soul for another person to enter and engage in a conversation. And let me kind of unpack three of the things that he talks about here. One is this sense of undividedness. We talked about purity with James, and you see here kind of a purity of attention. There's all this, he calls it a din, it's all this background noise, and it's kind of like, okay, that's just become a distraction. Let's have a quiet place that you and I can just sit and talk. And David Benner is a person who writes a fair bit of stuff on spiritual formation things, and he wrote a book, I believe it's called Soul Hospitality. And I'm just going to pick up a little bit of his thinking and turn this into part of my conversational hospitality. But here's what he says about soul hospitality. He says, "Prepare your soul like you prepare a house for visitors. Soul hospitality is taking another person into my space, into my life, being a soul friend. Soul hosts prepare the gift of hospitality by cultivating a place of quiet within themselves, a place where they will receive others. If I have no such place within myself, if I'm unable to offer a gift of soul, I'm unable to offer a gift of soul hospitality. But as I learn to be a person with a quiet center, I can invite others to come in and rest there. It is out of a quiet place we offer the gifts of presence, stillness, safety, and love." That just doesn't sound like 2024. And I mean, it's easy in things like this to point your finger at social media. And I thought about that and I said, yeah, that's right. We should point our finger at social media. Because it really does do that to us. But there's lots of other things around us. I worked out sometimes in a gym, you know, doing treadmill or that kind of a thing. And one of the places I do that has Fox News going on. And it's like I get 45 minutes of the world is going to end. And there's this other place I go to sometimes for a meal, and they have the TV going there, and it's MSNBC. And guess what? The world's ending over there too. And I went to a friend's house, and they were a person who had Fox News on 24 hours a day. And after being in the house for a day or two, I just am feeling that sense of anger, animosity, and antagonism build up within me. And it isn't that I even disagree even with the opinions. It's what's going on in my heart that I suddenly realize whatever I may have gained by listening to these polarized news sources on either side, what I've lost as a quiet place in my heart from which I might receive and extend conversational hospitality to another person. I've sacrificed that on the altar. Second thing that is interesting to pay attention to in this context is the idea of uninterrupted time. Notice Aelred describes this thing. Now everyone else is gone. We're closing. The meeting's over. We can talk. Pour out. I am here to listen. And as I look back at my life, some of the great joys that come to my mind are these really, really good conversations that didn't really get good until the second or third hour. And in a world of conversations done with our thumbs on a smartphone, those conversations never happen. And I don't want to be cranky about, let's burn down all the text messages, but it's a sorry replacement when the only thing we offer one another is something you could do with your thumbs. And the long conversations we lost. One of my favorite memories is with two of my friends who were both kind of pretty high-powered business kind of folks. And we had grown up together, had a long relationship. They both were living at a distance, so we began to do some things because they were sort of accountability partners and friends. We'd do some things to draw us together. And so we just said, okay, we're going to get together and we're going to set aside this day. And we basically would usually get together about the middle of the afternoon. And the phrase was, we're done when we're done. That's what we told our wives. When do I expect you home? When we're done. And we would do the long story of what's going on in each of our hearts. The average length of those meetings was about 9 hours. We probably spent about 3 hours apiece talking through what was really going on in our own hearts. We gave each other the gift of conversational hospitality by being willing to pay the one price that so few of us are willing to pay, and that is the price of attention. Uninterrupted, unmediated, unshort-circuited attention. What a gift. What a gift. Finally, let me just note that Aelred describes what you might call the absence of an agenda in this conversation. He says, yes, most beloved, open your heart now and pour out whatever you please into the ears of a friend. He said, I don't have an agenda here except you. So talk to me about what's on your heart. And that was what I had done with my friends on that count as well. But let me just point out, it's good to talk about some of those things that are on your heart that we often do. Let me suggest a couple of things that we have forgotten to talk about or we get afraid of talking about. Is what you might call things that we doubt or things that puzzle us. I think we as evangelicals have an anxiety about if someone says something that's departing from our sense of what the norm is, that we'll suddenly be like ostracized or not be member in good standing. So we don't want to talk about it. But the problem is things like that, doubts and fears of that nature are like a fungus. The only thing that holds them at bay is a little bit of sunshine. You got to take them out in the light. And you need to have safe places to talk about those kinds of things. When you're wondering what's going on, one of the great gifts you can have is a person that you can figure out what's going on together. Providing places of openness, safety, and security for people to kind of contemplate what's really going on, to be curious. Have you ever thought about this? And to have that open conversation about something that might otherwise be contentious. All of those things are things that open the door to the light of the gospel. They don't cast the darkness of doom on things. So let us be encouraged to join James in being people who sow the seeds of peace that we might gain the harvest of righteousness in our families, in our churches, and in our public spaces. Let us be people of peace. Lord Jesus, we thank you for the gift of your word. Thank you for the exhortations of James. We thank you that because you have spoken your word, we can speak good words to others. And let us be people who are agents of your peace, that your will might be done in the time and place where you have put us. And we ask this now in Jesus' name. Amen.